Welcome to Liberty Station. I'm Bryce Eddy, and I'm in for Rob McCoy, who is out fighting to save the Republic, as usual. So he's on a little bit of an extended tour now, and so I get to host the show solo for a couple of days. And I'm excited about today because I've got a couple of awesome guests, and I think we're going to do a little bit of part two with you guys, too, because you both have so much to talk about. But I'll introduce you guys, and then I'll have you tell your story. So I'm with Ryan Heath of the Gavel Project, and Dr. Robert, how do I say it?
Yoho.
Okay. Yep. I'm excited about talking to you, sure. Both of you, but because I just this weekend watched Dope Sick in kind of this, quick binge watching kind of a thing, and you are an expert in big pharma corruption. So.
Right.
With that, and Ryan, maybe starting with you, give our crew and everybody who's watching us, a little intro to who you are and what you're doing, and then we'll go with the good doctor next.
Yeah, so I am a constitutional attorney. I basically started a nonprofit organization called the Gavel Project, and what we're doing is we're actually bringing lawsuits against school districts across the state of California under the Civil Rights Act to pursue basically an opportunity to set precedent ending all COVID-19 mandates across the country. That was the objective that we had. And we're taking on all sorts of issues as well. It's not just the COVID-19 litigation. We're going after all sorts of nonsense in society. So if you're trying to change little boys into little girls, we want to sue you. If you're trying to teach kids that their futures are governed based on the color of their skin, not based on their capacities as an individual, we want to sue you. Those are the types of issues that we're going after. Basically, we have an application process on our website, thegavelproject.com, and we have a case selection committee that actually considers these cases. And whatever they decide they want to go after, as long as there's some sort of societal benefit, we will pursue those cases.
Okay, so do you have... Is this a number of lawyers that are on your team? I mean, how are you guys structured? And tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so basically it's myself and my wife are on the board. We also have another wonderful individual named Catherine Rahimian. She's on our board as well. She's a mother out of Orange County. But we have this application process for representation, and we actually contract attorneys out. So I help kind of lead and strategize for these cases. And actually, we set up lawsuits a lot of the time. So one of the things that I did early on is I realized that masking is something that is expressive conduct. Refusing to wear a mask, taking it off your face, is something that the Supreme Court says, and they said a long time ago, is protected free speech. Because anyone looking at that action would understand it, any reasonable person would understand it based on the circumstances to mean something. Any action that's inherently communicative is protected speech. That's why you can burn an American flag in a park. Not
right.
Get in trouble. It can't be illegal because someone looking at that act of protest is going to understand it as meaning something, meaning protest. The same thing is true when you take off your mask in a class when you're supposed to be wearing it. So I flew out to California in early January and a few other times throughout February and March to help teach kids about their rights here, under the state laws, under the Constitution, and I helped lead civil disobedience and
right.
Set up these lawsuits.
Because you guys are headquartered in Arizona, is that right? Or
yeah, well, I'm an Arizona-based attorney, but we're headquartered wherever I am at the moment. So
right, okay,
yeah,
all right, fantastic. So you're taking cases all over. So you've got it set up that you're the quarterback of these efforts.
Yeah, exactly.
What area of law were you always practicing constitutional law, or what was your area of expertise?
Yeah,
before?
So
how'd you get into this?
It's funny. I was actually in D.C. in January of 2020, still in law school, and I was in a class being taught by Justice Alito of the U.S. Supreme Court on constitutional interpretation. And going through that process, being one of 16 students selected from my school to be in this class, it was an honor. But I really do have a wonderful background, and I was blessed to go to Regent University School of Law. If you know Pat Robertson, he actually owns that school, CBN. Yeah, his house is literally a stone throw away from the law school. Being there, I was really blessed to have a full year of constitutional law as a student there. It's a standard as opposed to just one semester. So I was top of my class, but I did get an A in that class in First Amendment. And I'm passionate about the issue. So
right.
I understand it pretty well.
All right. Awesome.
Yeah.
Doctor, tell us about you.
Okay, Bryce, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for giving me the platform. You don't have to doctor me. We're colleagues here, so you can call me Robert, and I'll call you Bryce, if that's okay.
All right,
I got to do the 10-second disclaimer. This is not medical care. It's use it at your own risk. If you have medical problems, you have to see a licensed provider. I'm not your doctor. So that said, my journey started about 5 years ago when I was still practicing. I've been retired about 3 years, and I was prescribed. It's kind of convoluted, but bear with me a second. I was prescribing hormones to women who were over 50, over through the change of life, and it made a miraculous difference. I was a cosmetic surgeon, and a lot of these guys just operate on anyone. And when their real problem is hormone deficiencies, and they, so they were trying to treat hormone deficiencies with surgery, and that sometimes works, but it's not optimal.
It's interesting to quick little tangent. So my wife just is recovering from a fibroid surgery that fibroid happened because of hormonal imbalances, and we didn't know what was really going on with, you know, her over the last couple of years. And, but something was changing within her, and, you know, and then thankfully, you know, we got it properly diagnosed and sorted out. But hormonal issues both in men and women, which, you know, there's all kinds of different reasons why we might go through those. But it can be devastating.
The main thing is we get older, and most people over 50 could benefit greatly from bioidentical hormones.
Right.
And I've seen it over and over with I had primarily a woman practice because it was cosmetic surgery. So I would just say, look, if you're interested, I'll put a little implant in you and you can try it out for 3 months. And I didn't even charge. I didn't charge for the materials, and I had them sign a consent form and I told them about it. But they come in at 2 weeks and they'd be doing backflips. And it wasn't because their boobs were bigger.
Right.
It was because they just felt so much better. Anyone who's after the change of life, these women fall off a hormonal cliff at 50. The men have the dwindles for, 30 or 40 years. And we decrease our testosterone 1% a year or something like that. So I studied this material, and I saw a lot of crazy stuff with black box warnings on all our major hormones. That means the FDA has specifically warned that they are damaging, they cause cancer, blood clots, heart attacks. And as I studied the literature, I realized what an outrage it was. And I eventually started to understand that the FDA is entirely a creature of big pharma. They are a marketing arm of the pharmaceutical companies, and the pharmaceutical companies have more criminal settlements than any industry in history. In other words, they are mobsters. And this is not my characterization. Peter Rost, who was a VP for Pfizer, that's his characterization. He called them mobsters. And, one of these guys, CEOs, Harry Lloyd from Park Davis, he said, if we put horse manure in a pill, we could sell it to some of these doctors. So they don't care about anything except for the money. And
I was just going to say, I went to a I was a buddy who works in the pharmaceutical business as a high up sales guy, invited me, and this is going almost 20 years ago, invited me on one of their trips because his wife was pregnant. So I was his plus one. And I remember being grossed out is probably the best term I can use, because it just felt so sick to me listening to the sort of promotional discussion on how they were going to get these docs to write more scripts.
Yeah.
It was all about, how to essentially manipulate the doctors and, do those dinners and take them out and get them this. And, let's get these scripts out there versus anything about the real needs of the patient. And it bothered me at this, gut moral level. And of course it was super extravagant, and I'm all for rewarding salespeople and everything there, but it was such a weirdly perverse universe to be in and get exposure to.
Nobody's running the asylum now. And we give these people our federal money, our insurance money, and we shower it on them, and they return by bribing our legislators and turning the whole game in their favor. I mean, it is crazy. And it's just a unique blend, a perverse blend of capitalism and socialism is what we have with a corporatism, really.
Well, that's good, because of course online, people, argue for socialism on these, social websites, and they push towards that idea that that's going to solve it, when you don't solve corruption by, you know, putting in more government interference on top of more corruption, because socialism is just as corrupt as anything else because it's, you know, human beings that are in charge of it. But they always point to capitalism. They point to corruption to deride capitalism. And then they point to some kind of, you know, hopeful utopia to promote socialism, which I always find funny.
Bryce, you interrupted my rant.
I do that from time
sorry,
to time.
I'm sorry.
I okay, do that I'm just, from time to
let me,
time.
Let me continue another 30 yeah. seconds. Okay, so
my bad.
So the FDA conspires with pharma to ruin their drug studies. You know, they're required by the drug companies are required by law to submit these studies to the FDA, and then they're approved through an approval process. Well, the FDA is more than half funded by pharma because they get fees during the patent application process called user fees. And so they're working hand in glove, and these studies get ruined by statistical manipulation, like we saw with the COVID vaccine. I mean, that it was just an outrage. They put the inactive group, they poured it into the active group at 3 or 4 months, something like that. And that ruins any study, so we'll never know whether these things work or not. And they use this idea of the absolute versus the relative risk, and they confuse everybody, including the doctors. The doctors, I didn't understand this till I started studying it. You know, they say you're 53% more likely to not have the disease if you take the drug. Well, this might be a tenth of a percent phenomenon, but there are very small numbers involved, and you could have an improvement like that would actually be inconsequential. Maybe that's too dense for this audience, but so anyway, the journals and the medical literature is completely bought and sold. Also, it's an outrage. Really, you cannot depend on anything you read. You certainly understand that you can't depend on the legacy media of any kind: Facebook, CBS, NBC, all those things, Fox. They're completely unreliable.
Well, they're all brought to you by Pfizer.
Yeah. Exactly. 75% yeah. of all TV advertising is pharmaceutical drug company related, and almost all of the news is pharmaceutical drug company related. So their narratives get through because they're paid for.
Mm-hmm. Which, other than, I think, New Zealand, we're the only ones that allow that.
That's right. Two countries in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which again... you know, these things, you know, they can't help it almost now because it is their, you know, the entirety of their revenue almost, right? So it's as if you can't unwind it.
No.
So they're all invested in continuing to double down on it.
When Great Britain had doubts about the SSRI, the Prozac class of drugs, they were threatened because the huge manufacturers are in Great Britain. It's maybe their biggest industry, one of the top several anyway. It's crazy.
I didn't realize yeah. that. So they SSRIs primarily,
I believe look, I don't want to quote this since yeah. I'm not 100% sure, but yeah. but these companies are a consequential part of their gross domestic product,
right.
and they can threaten a country if they're not the drugs are not approved.
Yeah. Wow. So shifting gears back to you, Ryan. So the mask thing, because there's a little bit of the same sort of thing going on with CDC, right?
Yep.
You know, the CDC is an incredibly corrupt organization as well. I don't think anybody read the actual study that they promoted on masks, and I've said it on the podcast before. I remember reading a lot of it because I was curious, and the study, you know, the headlines were all, you know, promoted by the CDC that, you know, masks, you know, have amazing efficacy, right? You know, that was the gist of you know, oh, masks are great, you know, was their message that they put out. But if you actually looked at the study, it showed that they were marginally helpful at best, if at all, and yeah. if used
Bryce,
properly.
We have 200 mask studies, and they don't work at all.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's terrible. I mean,
but then you throw them on kids, and there's absolutely zero logical reason to put masks on your kids, and only detrimental reasons that we know, both from common sense and, you know, any kind of person who studies childhood development knows that it's a terrible thing.
Because the disease does not affect kids, period. It does yeah. not kill kids.
Yeah. yeah.
You can't find a kid that died from COVID without underlying problems.
Yeah. And when you say underlying problems, like
something
leukemia
yeah.
and,
obesity,
you know, they're, yeah,
cystic well, fibrosis, something really
yeah,
bad.
Something where they yeah. are, they are they're not compromised. Expected to live.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because you have basically all of these school districts here in California that had required masks across the board universally without even considering the risk-benefit analysis for these children at all. And a lot of it had to do with government funding. A lot of it has to do with corruption. You have the California Department of Public Health working in tandem with the California Department of Education under Gavin Newsom's rule, where one entity, the California Department of Education, was basically saying, hey, look, if you want access to these ESSER funds, this is the COVID stimulus money that went out through the American Rescue Plan. If you want to access these funds, you have to follow the CDPH guidelines. That's what the education department was saying. So basically, they put strings on all of these tens of millions of dollars that were going out to the schools so that if they wanted to keep operating as an entity, they had to adopt these guidelines, and therefore they made them, you know, mandatory. And that's why when you go around to all these school districts, they kept saying to the parents, like, hey, we're required to mask your children. We have we're obligated to do so. This is a law. This is a mandate. Even though the mandate they were referring to were called guidelines, it didn't make any sense at all.
That was like the stewardesses on the flights. They would say, it is federal law. You know, now some of them were savvy enough where they would say it is a federal mandate, but many of them were just conditioning you themselves, mm-hmm. or they were conditioned in their minds, you know, depending on the airline. But a lot of them came out and stated that it is federal law for you to wear a mask and wear it properly.
It's a blatant lie.
Well, continuous, of course, but that's how they condition you over time. Oh, okay, I guess we are supposed to do this, you know? And they would have never gotten away with most of this stuff if they had told us, you know, at the 2 weeks to slow the spread time, you know, if they had told us, okay, here's what we're going to do, folks. Everybody could be like, you know, baloney, forget it. You know, we reject that.
Yeah. It went on way too long. I mean, I was in law school when COVID happened still. Graduated in 2020 during the pandemic, actually took the bar in a mask, and I was watching all of this happen, and I just couldn't stand by any longer. After going to work for a year and kind of seeing society continuously degrade, I decided at one point I had to jump in. And so I decided to start a nonprofit and really pursue justice on behalf of the kids that were being abused. So that's why I'm here. I'm out in California for that reason.
Ryan's got a lot done in a very short period of time.
I love
it. And he's got a lot of interest in his work.
Thank you.
Yeah, how did you guys connect?
We connected through those people at the BS Free MD.
Doctors Tim and May Hindmarsh. Yeah.
Okay.
So I connected through them through Dr. McCullough. He's actually a part of the organization.
Okay.
He's
Fantastic.
On our case selection committee. So if you're applying for representation and you want to help, actually vaccine injuries is one of the things that we want to take on. We have an argument to go after the PREP Act, which is what grants these vaccine manufacturers, you know, liability protection for the emergency use authorization products, which are everything here. So assuming we can get the funding to go after that, we will.
Amen. Well, what I'm excited about, and you know, you guys met Rob on the mm-hmm. way into the studio, and not Rob McCoy, but my buddy Rob, who, you know, we were talking about, on the way in today about how wonderful it has been this time in bringing people together.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, you guys meeting, you know, there are these coalitions that are forming of people that are understanding that something's not just wrong, but there's criminal behavior going on. Or, you know, in some of the ways they've designed these laws to protect them and allow them to do these things. And so, you know, I like to use the term criminal because many of these things are criminal. And I hope you go and you are able to use the law to go after these folks. But also, they're immoral, right? And there are many things that are legal that are not moral. And I say this all the time, and many things that are moral that are not legal. And that's the world that we're in. And we used to be, just as Christians and the world that we were in before, morality reigned supreme. And morality was our ultimate guide. And then we had the law in order to support that and to support our efforts and, you know, formalize those things that we needed to formalize into, you know, our legal structure. But you answered to your morality first. And that was outside of you, and it wasn't something that we invented in our own hearts. But what's allowed these folks to get away with this stuff is because now all they do is look at what's legal versus not legal and what can we get away with. And that's how the corruption in the pharma industry goes.
Bryce, it's a lawless time.
Yeah.
And what I say is our feet are in the alligator's mouth. Even though these forces seem overwhelmingly powerful. We have no choice but to struggle. We got to beat this thing somehow. If we don't, our children are going to get eaten up.
Yeah, amen. Agreed.
And you mentioned criminality, and I agree with you. What they are doing is criminal. And very unfortunately, though, we will not see charges brought because of prosecutorial discretion.
A law doesn't exist if they don't prosecute.
Yeah. So as an attorney, I believe the only solution here, because prosecutors do have basically plenary discretion as to whether or not they bring charges against these individuals, the real answer is in the civil courts. And to go after people personally, not just the school districts, not just the the politicians that are taking away our rights, or the agencies, but actually the people personally. And the Civil Rights Act, Title 42, Section 1983, says that if you are engaged in an act of free speech, you can actually sue the government actor personally who violates your rights. And so that's really my approach. I'm going to go after the school board trustees. We're suing the principals. We're suing the teachers. It's not just the districts. And they stop when you hit them where it hurts, which is their pocketbooks. It's my thought.
Yeah.
I never thought I'd say this, but thank God for the plaintiff's attorneys, okay? I hate plaintiff's attorneys. Most of them are the scum of the earth. But look, they saved us from, they took Purdue out. This is relevant to your, and they took out INSYS, both of which manufacture opioid, but both of which had the blood of hundreds of thousands of people on their hands from the overdoses and all the problems we've had.
Yeah. I know they took some artistic licenses. They always do with that story, with Dope Sick, right?
I've read the background and I can describe it in a few words.
Yeah, please.
Okay. So basically, opioids were regarded as very serious medications with great consequences and were treated very carefully before about 20, 25 years ago. And at this time, Purdue Pharma was the ringleader and they produced a new ethic. There was a study on their drug called, what was it? The opioid that they use in a pill,
Oxycontin. Yeah,
that claimed that it was not addictive and could be used for virtually anything. There was a paper in Scientific American that came out about the tragedy of unneeded pain, and this thing started to change the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age. And these things came to become used promiscuously, and the opportunistic doctors in prescribing mills would give out this stuff to anyone for a price. You know, you come in, pay $200, and you get 200 of whatever you want. And so it happened that we exposed the entire population to opioids, which are tremendously addictive, and in a few percent, perhaps 3 to 5%, maybe more, of people, they get sucked into it and they think of nothing but opioids the rest of their lives.
I've got a personal story on that. One of our family members, had a little knee injury that, got over-prescribed. I mean, I think this doctor prescribed like 100 pills or something stupid like that, at the time. And this kid, I mean, he was, young, 18, 19 at the time, got quickly addicted, had a little bit of that kind of personality anyway, and it led to heroin and other things. And I know he's off of that now, but I mean, a decade of abuse.
No, most of us don't seem to be vulnerable. We take it, we stop it. We don't like the sensations, but there's something about this percent of the population. And they just are stuck on this stuff or start thinking about it or stuck scarfing for enough money to buy their next hit.
Yeah.
So what happened was the publicity got on this and, we had bankrupted these couple of companies with it. Thank goodness for the plaintiff's lawyers, right? And they made money on it, of course. So, I lost my thread there. So
you were summarizing the Purdue saga. There
yeah.
With
so
Oxycontin.
Purdue is not the only bad actor. The wholesalers, the three big wholesalers in America, including McKesson, passed this stuff out to the pharmacies indiscriminately. The pharmacies sold it indiscriminately, and then as the prices went up, as the screws were tightened on the doctors, as well they should be, the illegal black tar heroin came in from Mexico, and you could buy this stuff on the steps of the pill popper clinic, right? You could buy it right outside there. It was much cheaper, and they were more service oriented than the doctors. In other words, they deliver it and all this stuff. So it continued the addiction, and the social disasters, and our number of people who've died of overdoses has continued to escalate during COVID.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an out, even though we're kind of aware of the problem, the idea has swung back to the idea that these things should only be used for cancer, end of life care, severe pain after surgery. And incidentally, the orthopedics surgeons are notorious for not focusing on the addictive thing, and they're notorious for overprescribing. Here, take this, you'll be fine. We don't want any problems with your pain.
Yeah.
So that's how it degenerated, and it's still a problem. I mean, it's still an insane problem.
It is. I mean, I went down as a part of our security firm, and you know, we were filming a documentary down at the border, and so we were part of the operation, and watching what they're doing in terms of the importation and smuggling of fentanyl and, you know, everything else that's happening. So, I mean, it's not done at all. I mean, taking out a couple of pharmaceutical companies, what they unleashed, and then what our enemies, because a lot of this stuff is coming in intentionally and being pushed, you know, mm-hmm. into our country intentionally.
By our enemies within.
Enemies within and enemies on the outside. Yeah. I mean, both foreign and domestic actors are you know, creating this cancerous condition, you know, within our cities mm-hmm. and within our small communities. And I mean, you're seeing the open air drug markets, you know, in Venice Beach, you know, here not too far from here, in San Francisco, and all of this stuff of the transient populations. Most of them are addicted to these hardcore drugs.
So, to back up for your audience, just to define the fentanyl thing, fentanyl is a very short acting opioid, which has been used successfully in surgery because it'll go away quickly. You know, they can give pop them with a little fentanyl every few minutes, and they stay down, and then they stop it, and then they wake right up and they can breathe and so on. But it's being sent here from China in small packages, and it can be sent with not get caught by customs. So you can have it. And the problem with this stuff is the overdoses are so much easier. It's so much easier to overdose on something that's enormously powerful.
Yeah.
It's getting mixed with all kinds of other stuff, and the people mm-hmm. buy it. They don't know what it is. Take a small amount. And, you know, there's a trend now to allow the reversal agent into the schools, into the, you know, it's Narcan. And so some people have that, but it's thought that allowing the opioid reversal agent to be given by anyone has allowed these drug addicts to think, well, now I can try anything. You know, now I can I can use more. That's
their
mentality.
I've got my get out of jail free card.
That's their mentality.
And, yeah, no, it's disturbing. I watched, you know, while we were down on our operation, we had Narcan with us. Because we know the threat of just any kind of small exposure. And there's a video that was making the rounds of a sheriff that opened a trunk and immediately got, you know, hit with fentanyl, just, you know, opening the trunk of the smuggler's car and you know, collapsed within seconds. And, you know, the other officers were able to revive him with Narcan and then, you know, get hazmat out there to deal with it. But it's amazing how small a dose can kill you. And the fact that this thing is running around on the street, I mean, it's Russian roulette that these kids are playing with only one barrel of the gun empty. You know, I mean, that's how risky it really is.
Yeah, there's even a more short-acting one that fortunately hasn't seemed to hit the market now, you know, that the anesthesiologists use.
Yeah. Yeah, well, don't give anybody ideas.
It's funny, all of this tying it back into the Gavel project. I actually, when I was 17, I had some issues with pain pills. I blew my knee out 4 times playing football growing up.
Uh-huh.
Had 2 surgeries back to back. Had my leg locked out in a straight leg brace for nearly a year, and ended up basically just not taking a break from the opioids once I started taking them. And it was easier for me as a disturbed young man, had some issues, you know, personally, just as any teenager does. It's hard growing up, and I went a little bit off the deep end. I got in trouble, ended up having to go live in the woods for 2 months, and went to boarding school for 10 months, and spent all my college money on that, and had to work my way through college, worked 3 jobs at a time at one point to pay
Amen.
For it. Yeah, graduated debt-free, and I believe that God put me here for this reason. I have a background in it, and I really do want to go after Big Pharma, and we've got some arguments to do it. So
I love it.
So this is an innocent exposure by an orthopedist that started the whole thing.
Yeah.
And you never used street opioids, did you?
No, I was lucky enough to my parents got me help before I got far enough down that road. And even as someone who went through that program, shout out to the folks at the Oakley School, if you're listening, anyone out there, I'm lucky.
Yeah.
You know, there many of the people that I went to the, through this program with went back on the drugs. Some of them have subsequently passed away. You know, I'm not in contact with many of them anymore, but it's hard. Something like a huge percentage, I think it was 80% is the number I'm remembering, but I don't know if that's right, go back into to rehab immediately afterwards. It's like you never get off these things.
Well, listen, thank you for sharing that, because, man, I know that there's people in our audience that have, you know, experience with it. I know there's, you know, people who've got kids that are, you know, having trouble, because we, you know, we hear from them, and we know we've got those folks that are being impacted by it, you know, here in our church. Yeah. So it's great to, you know, hear from people who have, you know, made it through, because it is everywhere. And I mean, it terrifies me, you know, because, you know, thankfully I've never been in a position where I've ever had to have major surgeries or anything like that, to where, you know, I've even been, you know, been prescribed anything, you know, more powerful than an Advil. And I know how quickly those things can grab people.
It doesn't happen to everyone, and you probably wouldn't be addicted. You know, you'd probably be fine.
I just,
and you
should knowing
use
what
those
I know
appropriately.
Well, knowing what I know, I personally, I have no desire to take the chance. Is what it feels like, because I've seen too many people around me, you know, get wrapped up in it. You know, because it's tough. But yes, I agree. So talk. Let's, if we can, circle back to the mask thing, and let's talk. I mean, have you had some victories recently, or, you know, what's happening, you know, right now in the environment with what you're doing?
Yeah. So actually, there are a lot of kids right now that are being put back in masks. So Berkeley Unified School District on Friday announced they'd be putting the mask back on kids. I know that San Mateo Unified School District, I think that's up near San Francisco, actually announced, even though the CDC recommended against it, even though the California Department of Public Health recommended it against it, they actually never took the masks off the kids. Those kids up there are still in masks. They've never taken them off. And they're adopting that policy until the end of, basically, end of the school year, so June 7th or something like that. But the fact is, you don't have to wear a mask if you're a student in California, because the California Education Code is very clear on this issue.
Right.
And so is the California Constitution. The California Constitution says you have a right to an in-person education. And there are only a few reasons that a school can remove you from campus under California law. And those are if you're a clear and present danger, meaning you have guns, drugs, paraphernalia, you are a threat to yourself or someone else on campus. They can kick you off for that. They can suspend you against your will. They can also take you off campus if your parents consent. So basically, you should go to my website if you're interested. If you're out there, you're subject to a mask mandate. Thegavelproject.com. There's an ultimatum there. It's basically a cease and desist letter that I drafted with the help of another wonderful attorney named Tracy Henderson. Mm-hmm. She runs California Parents United. And actually, she just started a wonderful organization, a California Parents Union. We're taking on the teachers unions here in California, trying to go after them and destroy them.
Awesome, because that is a evil gangster cabal right there.
Yeah, we can get back to the teachers union in a second, but the California Education Code 48900 says basically clear and present danger is what they can kick you off for. They can't kick you off for anything less than you being those things. And so, you know, for them to say that they can remove you for taking your mask off, I mean, are you a clear and present danger if you're a child and you remove your mask if you're perfectly healthy? The answer is no. You're not a danger to anyone. You're just a kid. And you're basically doing the same thing that kids have done in this country for the last, I don't know, 150 years in the public education system. You are going to school normally. And what is disruptive to the educational process, basically there's this one section in the law they try to cite. It's 48900K. And it says that you can be removed for willful defiance of a valid authority, valid orders, or if you are disruptive to the educational process. And that's actually reflective of a Supreme Court case called Tinker v. Des Moines. And that's the case that we rely on most for our free speech arguments. Basically, there was a few students back in during the Vietnam War in Iowa that decided they wanted to wear black armbands to protest the Vietnam War. There was a school ordinance passed saying you couldn't do that. You can't wear black armbands to school to protest the war. Kids did anyway. They filed a lawsuit under Title 42, Section 1983, the same way we're doing it now. And they brought it all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court says, look, this is expressive conduct. And the standard for it is basically you as a student have a right to engage in free speech so long as that speech doesn't infringe on the rights of other students or disrupt the learning environment. And I have to, the issue we have basically is the school saying, well, you're disrupting the learning environment by taking your mask off. Well, not really, because you're just a kid taking your mask off. What is disrupting is the school's response, the school's responses to these protests. They've actually, we have a client named Troy down in Capistrano Unified School District. He's one of the bravest young men I've ever met. 16 years old, decided to protest the mask mandate at his school. And for 3 days, he actually had the Orange County Sheriff's Department show up. And 3 days in a row, he offered, hey, look, I've been suspended for refusing to mask in class. He was sneaking back into the classrooms. I was actually on the phone with him, teaching him how to do this the whole time. And he said, I'm not going anywhere. And when the cops showed up, he said, if you want to arrest me, I'm trespassing, go ahead. You don't even have to put the cuffs on me. I'll walk right out of here. His parents were there too. They said, go ahead. They refused to do it because he wasn't breaking any laws. He had a right to be there. California Education Code 201, Section 201, says you have a right to an education free of harassment and discrimination.
Yeah. And by the way, that, folks, is why we need strong sheriff's departments, too, because a lot of that came from the sheriff, you know, directing those guys, look, let's not do that. Because if it's the wrong police departments, will. And as we progress in our sort of tyrannical rule, you know, the police will not be our friends, but the sheriffs could be, because the sheriffs, you know, they're elected, and the, you know, the local police serve at the, you know, the city council's pleasure. And that's where, you know, decentralized policing is so important, because you need those people that'll stand up.
How do you suggest we support our sheriffs?
Well, you know, get involved in electing, you know, guys that are not down with tyranny. And there's, you know, thankfully we've got two pretty good sheriffs. We've got a sheriff that chose not to arrest Rob McCoy here in town that is running for a second term, and we've got someone that's opposing him that, you know, also is not down with the idea of, you know, arresting people who are opening their churches in defiance of the state. So, our emphasis and everything that we believe is you need to get into these local races and you need to win these local things, because, you know, we don't believe that there's a, you know, big chance to win these statewide races here in California. You know, there's a lot of corruption and there's a lot of crazy things that are going on at the state level in California. But, you know, if we win at the school board levels and we win on city councils and we win, you know, local dog catcher races and everything else, then what Rob McCoy always says, we'll light 1,000 fires. And that's how we eventually take back the state. And that's what we need to be doing. And the sheriff's races are very key in that. So, yes, support your sheriff, get involved in those races, and make sure that you've got somebody that will stand against this tyranny.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I can't comment on that as someone who runs a nonprofit as far as, like, endorsing anyone, but I will say that it is so important.
No, but what you can say
educated.
Is get involved.
Yes,
you know, I mean, that's
and
because that's what that's what we all need to be doing. Is, you know, even at that nonprofit level, you know, it's not endorsing to say, hey, know what's going on,
sure,
pay
yeah.
attention, you know, and get out there and vote and find candidates to support.
Yeah.
Because that's what we need to be doing, because we abdicated all that responsibility, and the church was immoral. I was going to say criminal, but immoral. The church, you know, behaved immorally in leaving that all to the secular realm, and not standing up and being courageous.
Plato said that those who don't get involved with politics are destined to be governed by their inferiors.
Yeah,
and all of us have made the mistake of leaving it alone for 20 years, and I mean we've gotten red pilled, and now we're totally committed.
I love it. Can we go? I have a question in regards to the mask thing. Are you guys bringing up the developmental stuff that's going on? Because there's two things that alarm me. Number one, I have friends who, you know, who didn't, you know, like, we've homeschooled our kids. We kept our kids out of that. I would have started homeschooling our kids if we weren't already, you know, like I joked that we homeschooled before it was cool or mandated. I have friends that are really beside themselves right now because their kid wants to wear a mask. Like they feel like they have to, you know, like they're conditioned to, and part of it's out of fear.
They're groomed.
They've been groomed to. Yeah. Thank you. That is exactly what's happened is, you know, and so they are constantly, and, you know, my buddy I was with this weekend, he's going, yeah, I'm always telling my daughter, he goes, okay, my other two kids, you know, they're done with it, but I keep telling my daughter, you know, honey, take that off. And she keeps like sneaking a new one almost. Like it's like a comfort blanket. So how do we address that? Or are you guys talking to experts? And then what about just developmental language issues and things like that in these little kids?
Well, the little kids, we have a lot of clients that have special needs.
Right.
We have multiple kids with autism. We have multiple kids that have developmental issues. ADHD is one of those things that I have. I know it's debatable as to whether that's a thing. We can talk about that in a minute. It's interesting. But, you know, for me, I had to sit in the front of every single class to learn. I had to have very little distractions. I get distracted incredibly easy when I'm trying to study. And for a student like myself to be forced to put a mask on, there could be nothing more distracting. Or basically, you're putting a barrier to success, like a barrier in the way of success for these kids.
Yeah.
And we've seen the consequences of this. The statistics are shocking as far as this teen and child depression rates right now. There was a recent CDC study that came out showing that throughout the pandemic, it was a study of high school students across the country. 44% indicated, they basically responded, that they experienced persistent feelings of hopelessness or sadness throughout the pandemic. There was another CDC study that came out showing that comparing the summer of 2019 to the summer of 2020, the number of emergency room visits for suspected suicide attempts for children ages 12 to 17 rose 22% comparatively. When we shut things down, in February and March, the same study actually revealed there was a nearly the number of girls that visited the hospital for suspected suicide attempts nearly doubled when compared to the same period the year before. These policies that we are adopting for our children are having serious consequences. And it's not just the developmental stuff. It's the psychological trauma. It's the fact that kids now today are comforted by a piece of cloth that has zero efficacy in actually doing anything for them for their health. In fact, it has a lot of detrimental impacts. We're learning more and more that the plastics in these masks have actually leached into people's lungs and are having consequences there. It's really gross what we've done to our kids without even really thinking about it.
I heard this was anecdotal, but a friend of ours who's a photographer who takes family portraits says that the kids that were little in the pandemic, she couldn't get the little infants to smile. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they were not used to seeing smiling. And so they were like missing that cue. And so she remarked this to another couple that, you know, didn't have their kid ever masked up. And she's like, oh, I'm so glad I'm able to get your baby to smile. I can't get these other kids to smile. I mean, that sort of thing creeps me out. That's what we've created here. And some of these kids don't speak as well. These little kids that came up during the pandemic, because seeing the face, you know, seeing the lips move and all that stuff is so much a part of communication.
The name of the game has been to scare the living hell out of everyone in order to condition us for all these agendas. And you can imagine these kids the kids that are 2 years old, they haven't seen anything else in their entire life.
Yeah.
And the kids that are 7 years old, it's the third of their lives.
You know?
So, I mean, it's a criminal thing.
So, shifting gears a little bit, are you getting involved or are you even, touching the edges, both of you, with this just tremendous push towards, you know, transgendering these kids and hormone therapy chemical castration, mm-hmm. all that stuff? I mean, do you guys have any thoughts on that? Because that is moving so fast and so aggressively.
So, pronounce that woman's name for her, Abigail
Schreier.
Yeah, she wrote a great book. I read it.
Yeah, I finished that book and wrote a blog post on it. So I can summarize the whole thing in about 5 minutes.
Awesome. Let's do it.
Okay, so the way this works is, you know, the steps are, the kids always have basically, there are less than 0.5% transgenders in the country, total, adults. But these kids this is a grooming process for young girls primarily. They're the most psychologically vulnerable group that we have in our population. Mm-hmm. And the way it happens is these kids are subject to dramas, right? They have traumas, and some of them make a big deal about nothing. Some of them make a big deal about something, but there are always problems in their lives.
It's a very angsty time.
It's an angsty time of development. And my kids went through all kinds of developmental things that we just sat on, and they did fine. Ultimately, they did very well because we didn't get excited about any of it. And we certainly didn't have a pressure of a kid who was trying to convert to the other sex.
Yeah.
So what happens is they get online and they find these purple-haired people that are half
influencers.
Yeah, influencers. And these people groom these kids to think that this is a way out for them. Now, you got to realize that the most robust marker of transgenderism is their suicide attempt rate, which is around 40%. It's incredibly high. And this doesn't change after transition, and it doesn't change when they come back. It's basically the transgender transition produces no improvement in their psychological state, right? So anyway, the first step is they have an angst. The second step is they're told to get a breast binder. So these things they crack ribs, they damage the breasts, they make them flat, and they make them flaccid, and they make them stop developing, and they exacerbate asthma, and then they try that for a while. And they're groomed along a pathway. And the pathway, if your listeners haven't heard of this, they're going to think I'm like science fiction land making it up because it's incredible. Mm-hmm. So the next thing they typically try, and they're groomed to try by the transgenders who are promoting this and the transition counselors, and there's a whole and it's paid for by insurance. Hormones are, since birth control pill is paid for by insurance, they have interpreted that to mean that transgender drugs are paid for by insurance. So they are encouraged to do a shot called Lupron, which is a puberty blocker, which probably damages their brain, and it stops. It's used for prostate cancer and fertility, and it makes everybody feel terrible. So they get these shots, and then after that, the real marker for the transition is the administration of male doses of testosterone, which are 10 to 20 times what a woman needs. And whatever they need is being supplied by their ovaries anyway. So they take this stuff, and within 3 to 6 months, 3 to 4 months, they have permanent changes in their facial characteristics, their body characteristics, their voice deepens, their clitoris grows, and none of this is reversible, even if you stop it and decide to go back. So they do that, and then a lot of them decide to have a surgery that puts their urine through their clitoris, and they can, some of them build up the clitoris into a penis. I know it's horrible. You got an expression on your face.
Yeah.
You read the book, and the listeners are hearing this for the first time. I heard it for the first time when I read the book in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah. We're going to have to put a disclaimer on this.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, they take, patches of skin, artery and nerve and fat off the forearm, create a deforming scar, and build a penis out of it. And these, you can imagine, this is a complicated surgery. It's often botched. So it's the most insane thing. I mean, there's nobody running the asylum. The doctors are not, no one is requiring, very few of them are requiring psychological evaluations, and the psychologists are all crazy too. So the inmates, the crazy influencers, quote unquote, who are not happy people themselves, who have, one of the transgender people that was interviewed for the book says everybody hates their lives. They're very unhappy. It's universal before and after transition, and this transition thing is held up as a way out of pain.
Well, yeah, and they're taking, again, those angsty teenage years, right? You know, girls, I mean, my middle daughter, I have three of the most beautiful girls on the planet. My daughters are all gorgeous. And my middle daughter would swear that she was the ugliest human being on earth for like 2 years. She's 17, almost 18 now. She grew out of it. But if someone came along, if she didn't have, you know, strong mom and dad who were, you know, constantly just, you know, hey, knock it off. And also, no, that's not true. I love you. You know, and you know, if the home was broken, if there's, you know, other things going on in their lives, and they're getting on these blogs and they're getting in these, you know, forums and things like that where they're telling them
the grooming.
Yeah, they're telling them, I have an answer for you and this will make all your problems go away. I mean, that, you know, they're susceptible to that. You know, they're angsty, they're looking for, you know, for an answer. They're not finding it in, you know, Christ, and their parents aren't helping them. You know, these evil people are preying upon them.
We had a kid who was fascinatingly negative for all the way through that preteen, late adolescent phase. And she's blossomed into a wonderful person, very yeah. positive, getting married, wants to have kids and all that stuff, doing the normal development thing now.
Oh yeah. And my middle daughter's she's a superstar. I mean, she's amazing, but you know, all of them to, you know, varying degrees, you know, you go through these little funky times. I mean, it's hard. I mean, I think, you know, boys are a little bit different, I think, which is why it's a preponderance of girls that are outpacing it with the transgender stuff. You know, we've got, you know, we're just dumb and knuckleheaded.
Boys are not like girls.
but amazingly. Wait, yeah. What? Yeah. You're saying they're different?
A little
yeah.
different.
Yeah.
So the name of that book is Irreversible Damage.
Damage, yeah.
By Abigail
Schreier.
Schreier.
Yeah, and it's a hard read. It's an excellent read, though.
She's
a
poetic. She's really good.
Yeah, she lays it out. She talks to the family. She talks to the kids, the people.
She talks to the advocates. She's very sympathetic all around, but the facts alone, she doesn't get judgmental, but the facts lay out a horrible criminal, not criminal, but it's just a society degradation. It's horrible.
Yeah,
well, it's
wicked.
It's driven by actually the same people that are pushing the the vaccines on your children, the masks on your children as well. So I spend a lot of time speaking for my work. I travel throughout the state speaking at different school board meetings, different county board meetings as well. And I see patterns. It's one of the things that God gifted me with was pattern recognition. I see the same people advocating for both policies. And that's because at the end of the day, it's in the same financial interest. If you give hormones to children, make them permanently change, you have a lifetime customer now for the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, I was going to tie that in.
I'm glad you did.
Yeah,
I don't necessarily think that's the case. I mean, I have a hard time ascribing anything as crazy as this, even to the globalists. I mean, it's there and they're crazy. But there is supposedly a billionaire or two who funds a lot of transgender stuff. But I think it fits in with the Salem witch trials and the McMartin cases, which I can reference briefly. The witch trials were basically hysteria by adolescent children, and they were thought to be witches, and they got burned at the stake. The McMartin thing happened in my lifetime, and it was this idea of a repressed memory.
Yes, I remember that.
Was recalled, right?
Yeah.
But subsequent to that, this has been entirely discredited. For example, there are no repressed memories of the Holocaust that have ever been discovered. The documentation about the Holocaust is extensive. So it's total and utter fabrication by the psychologists. Yeah. And I had a psychologist who spent my money trying to convince me that I was sexually involved with my mother when I had no memory of it. That was during that exact same period. It was fashionable.
It was a fashionable trend.
So I think this should be classified as a hysteria, like some people classify multiple personality disorder as a hysteria. Yeah. It's typically young women, adolescent, pre-adolescent women, and they're just susceptible to it.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'm glad we're going to have a part two because we're going to get deeper on both of these things with you guys. So with that, we've run out of time for this episode, but we are having a part two. Well, folks, listen, appreciate you listening to us and all the things that are happening. We got to keep this fight up, and I love having warriors like you guys that are out there that are awake and helping us fight and getting after it. So. That's it for this episode. Thank you for joining us on Liberty Station, and tune in for the next one. Real quick, though, where do they find you guys?
Okay, so I'm at robertyoho.substack.com. You can subscribe to my newsletter. I'm also at robertyohoauthor.com.
Yeah, all right. And I'm at thegavelproject.com. You can find me online on Instagram, social media everywhere at The Gavel Project. And we are a 501c3 charity. We are in need of financial support. So if you are out there and you can give and you believe in the cause that we have, please go to our website, check out more about us, and give what you can.
And he says he takes Bitcoin.
We will take Bitcoin very soon, but we can.
That's an appreciated asset that you can give the full value of it and not have to pay taxes on it.
Yeah, but donations are tax exempt or tax deductible, excuse me. So please go on and give what you can.
Awesome. Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Bryce. Good night, folks.